Accession number 22065, Reel 3.
Dennis Avey, Reel 3. What division were you with in the desert?
I went up the desert with Wavell, General Wavell, and he formed the 7th Armoured Division. We were, for want of a better word, the Desert Rats, or the what it was known as the Jiboas. Jiboa is the well, that's how they used to call them. That was the name of them. Anyway, they were, you know what they're like, don't you? They have long legs at the back and in the same form as like a kangaroo, only much smaller. And God knows how they ever got food, I don't know, but there it was. There were a lot of them on the desert, and they used to burrow right into the sand as well. And that was our, that was the name of the division, and that was the figure that on flags and what have you that it became, and on to uniform as well. He was great. We had, for air support, we had two Lysanders. That was all. Now, two light planes, as you know. I don't think there was any armaments on them at all. All they used to do was to fly and locate and what have you. But Wavell, with the limited equipment he had, he was remarkable. I used to really respect that man.
Did you ever see him?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, a number of times. And for argument's sake, he got the Royal Engineers to come up on the desert and to build tanks of timber and Hessian and what have you. And those days, the Italian circus, for want of a better word, used to fly over. Big Savoyas and CR-42s used to fly over the desert, you know, and that was it. But first of all, the spotter planes used to come over, and that was the whole idea. They used to come over, and they built this big two or three squadrons of tanks, or supposed tanks, and then a little carrier used to go amongst them, kick up all the dust and what have you, tank tracks and what have you, and the spotter planes used to come over and very dutifully photograph, lovely. And about 3 or 4 hours' time, the circus used to come over. And bomb and bomb and bomb. It never used to touch one of the... It was fantastic. And they were most peculiar chaps. I remember one, well, it wasn't us that shot him down, but one of the Savoyas we shot down, and I should never forget them. He came into our section, and I've never seen such a uniform in my life. It was just like he'd been on the stage, you know. Absolute gold everywhere, medals, and God knows where they got the medals from. I don't, for jumping over bayonets, I think. And they were remarkable, immaculate boots, highly polished, and Lord knows what. Anyhow, that was them. And we did this several times, and it was, we used to do patrols a lot of not every night, but a lot of the time. And we used to do like road watching, like the LRDGs did. And we did a lot of that with them as well. That's the Long Range Desert Group, as you know. And we had several actions. And I always remember an action that we made. There was one of our tanks knocked out, and it had a lot of information in this tank, and it was behind the line. And I took a section to make this possible. to make this possible so that land tank recovery could be effected. And we got this tank. We didn't have any problems at all. No problems at all. Remarkable. And we must have been about good 15 miles into the known troop of that enemy troop at that time.
What were you able to do to that? You know, could you tell me about that exercise? The tank was disabled.
Well, the tank was disabled, and then, I mean, there was enough noise to wake a battleship up. What with a tank loader, it had to be brought on a tank loader as well. It had to be winched up, and we did all the security, outlying security of it. You see, and we set up action posts and what have you. And should have any action taken place, we'd covered them. And that was it.
So you would have sort of surrounded the tank with lookouts?
Oh, we made sections about half a mile out, a periphery around the tank like that, about half a mile radius, and did security posts, you know, with machine guns and what have you, automatic fire. I always remember, at the time, it was the first time I'd had the darn thing. And I really laughed at it. They gave me a Thompson submachine gun, you know, the Tommy guns that the gangsters used to use in Chicago. I really smiled about that. But the darn things were totally inefficient. 45, I think they were 45, and heavy, so heavy, totally impractical, totally impractical.
And how would the tank have been recovered? How would that have been done?
The tracks were damaged, and of course once the tracks are gone, that's it.
So how did they get it out?
What they do, this tank, these big whites, diesels used to come. They used to carry the tanks on these, and it went in front of the tank, and then a wire hawser would come from the white diesel itself, attach it to the tank, and take it up ramps and straight on to the tank recovery vehicle. Tremendous things they were. But that was in the early days. Of course, things are obviously subsequently different.
And you were saying it had a lot of information.
It had a lot of information in this tank, apparently, which I didn't know about or even wanted to know about. But it was essentially that this tank was recovered. And that was done. Anyway, that was neither here nor there. And, of course, this...
What was it like going on patrols? Could you describe, you know, what a patrol would be like in the desert?
Well, you start off you start off by dressing up without anything, minimum jangle. You don't have anything to make any noise at all. In point of fact, the whole idea is you face squad and you shake them and anything like that. You take away watches and things like that. Your fob watches that they used to use, oddly enough, those days. And anything that used to rattle or make any noise whatsoever was discarded. And then we did the briefing, what was afoot. We gave all the information because communication those days and still is of the utmost importance to any day, in everyday life as well. Communication is so important. And I learnt that very forcibly those days. And we discussed the situation. We knew map references. We knew exactly where we were going, what we had to do, etc., etc. Sometimes it was only reconnaissance. We picked, at night this was, incidentally, well, obviously. The thing that struck me, and it never occurred to us, although we were well camouflaged those days, never occurred to us, as they do today, to black out. It never occurred to us at all. And I always remember one of my chaps for those days, he had some desert sores and round his wrist. And he put a bandage on it. And we were very, very close to, so close it was impossible. And it was a little sanger that they'd put a little hutment on and what have you. And one of my chaps was right underneath this sentry. And he said, I thought about my bandage. And he said, I'm sure he saw me, but he knew I was there and he knew he'd get a shot if he made any movement towards me. He knew that and he turned around and went away. And it struck me, I always remember that white bandage. And of course that was the thing that we took notice of.
What were you doing on these patrols? What was the aim of them?
The aim of them was to try and locate and find the density of military equipment. For argument's sake, if we did, we tried to get what armaments they had in these sangars, what sort of guns, the type of guns, and the number of people that were there, the number of military that were there, and the type, what they were using, what they were doing, whether it was a hold-down position or a permanent position or whatever. These sort of situation. In point of fact, I was inside a big sangar before I'd realised that the sangar was completely all around me. And I walked from one end to the other. And you'd never believe this. Even on the desert, you heard these laughs of females. They had females on the desert, those. Whether they were Libyan girls or not, I don't know. But they had them there for creature comforts, no doubt. And I went from one end to the other and out the other side. No problem. Other times, we've done fighting patrols. We wanted a position eradicated. Or, in another situation, we've taken prisoners. We had prisoners to take. Those sort of things. And road watches we used to do a lot. That was mostly in the daytime. We used to go well behind the line and assess the traffic that was moving about. Traffic, not on a road, but across the desert, would you believe? Probably tracks. Tracks, as you would name them. And that was it. And one time when we were at Makalie, it was just before Makalie. I must tell you this, it was a bit risque, but I'm sure you'll appreciate it. We had some bad information, and I had to do a job, purely reconnaissance, that was all. And we had bad information. And we had the norm, you know, we had automatics, pistols, and Mohs bombs and what have you. And we'd run across this situation in the knowledge, we thought we were quite in the plane, and we got hit very badly. And I got away with about three of us, that was all three out of about 10 men. And I lost my compass. Well, not lost it, it was smashed. I lost my armaments, and the equipment was down to a minimum, all of us. And there we were. We finally consolidated and got back and started on the way back about 50 miles. This was all, as you can imagine, on an open desert. And I assessed whether we should travel the day or the night. As the day came about, as it became apparent, the hills, the few hills that were there, all the the amount that we could see and what have you. Now, on the desert at night, used to freeze. It could rain and freeze. It's very, very cold. First light, as soon as it hits you, first light, okay, immediately after that, 120 degrees Fahrenheit, without any doubt at all. But I decided we'd been going 2 days. We had very little water, no food at all. 2 days, and I decided to travel during the day, the next day. And we scooped sand off, and we all laid down beside each other to keep warm. And every half hour, one gets in between the other, and so on and so forth, to keep warm. Well, we were desperately tired, and when you're tired, and you really should keep your wits about you, but some people go into a sort of trauma, as I have done. And I always remember, I was dreaming of when I first got to Mirza Matru, and I saw this little bay, a beautiful bay with date palms and what have you around it, and hard sand, you know, and there's no tide, as you know, in the Mediterranean. And I was dreaming, I was on this little bay, there was nobody there, and I was lying on this hard sand. And I was, this sound was beautiful, and the sea was coming in, lovely, just rippling. And it was touching my face, you know, in my ears, and what have you. And this lovely, warm sea, and it's beautiful. And then I woke up. It was one of these poor fellows, in his sleep or wakefulness, he was on his knees, and he was peeing in my ear. Mm-hmm. And that was the warm water I was experiencing. And I thought about this many, many times. Poor fellow. It's the degree of tiredness and absolutely played out. Anyway, suffice to say, we got back. Okay, no problem. And that was it.
How did things change when the Germans arrived? How did things change when the Germans...
Oh, different. Very, very differently. Very differently. When I first saw the 110s come over at about 300 feet, never forget it as long as I live, I couldn't believe it. This was the first real aircraft we'd seen in any nearness at all. I mean, the old Italian circus used to fly at about 30,000, you know. Used to block out the sun nearly. There it is. But we were at near Fort McKayle. And we'd had a message over that we should go on a... It would be about 30... It was 36-hour march. Well, we used to call it a march. It was by carriers and PUs and what have you. All the 7th Armoured Division were ordered to go right across the desert to a place called Beda Fom, or Agadabia, or Ajudabia, as some people say. The intelligence that came about was that the Italians and half a German division are leaving Benghazi on the desert road. And we set off across desert. Even apparently, the Bedouins say it couldn't be traversed. It'd never been traversed by camel train, never mind about anything else. Well, the whole point of saying that was we lost half the 7th Armoured Division, half on. They ran out of petrol, they bogged down on rocks, God knows what. and we cut the coast road at Agadir or Biddeform. And just as we cut the coast road, down came the column, the entire Italian army and half a German division. Well, it was a metal road those days on the coast road there. And we were able to contain it very, very well. And as a result, there was hundreds of thousands of Italian military imprisoned, taken prisoner. And we sent them right across the desert as far as the eye could see, and about 100 abreast, going due east, you know, and that was it. And that was the first sign of the war, the number of prisoners that were taken. Hundreds of thousands were taken. And there was civilians as well. And we sent all the civilian people back into Benghazi, and we established a position further down the bay.
And the Germans, they made a big difference.
Oh, well, I'll tell you about the fact that we had this action and stopped the column, and we had very good positions, you know. We were hopelessly outnumbered, we would have been. But we had very good positions, and the surprise element was fantastic. They didn't believe, they were absolutely gobsmacked, so to speak.
What was that march like, though? You were saying you were going
across. Oh, it was terrible. It was terrible. We sweat, and then the sweat, and then all the ingress of sand, and we were just finished up with like a sand mask on our face, you know. That was it. We didn't stop at all, except to petrol, and we didn't stop to eat or drink or anything like that brewing up. No, nothing like that at all.
And were you all on vehicles? Or were you...
Oh, no, we didn't march. We were on vehicles. Yeah. I was actually in a carrier, a Bren gun carrier. Anyway, we made it. And we went into... We got a very good position each side of the road, and we stopped this column. And as I said, we took all these hundreds of thousands of prisoners. Well, they voluntarily went into. We sent all the civilians back. And then we went on an advanced situation about another 15 miles up the road. And we stayed there. No intelligence whatsoever. And then I was asked to do an inventory on a section of the column. Not anything specific, but there were other people involved in this. And I had a certain length of the column to do. And in it, in that length, I came across the most unusual thing in the world, I think, the Italian pay corps. The entire, what they'd done, they emptied all the banks in Benghazi in the crates. They used to keep notes in crates there. And this millions of lira. I couldn't get over it. And as I subsequently found out, you could take this lira to Cairo and get it changed 400 to the pound. 400. Well, we were left there with no intelligence whatsoever, no information. And I took a PU, one of the chaps' PU, and some of these crates were on this. Some of these money crates were on this PU. And I said, we'll have a look, see up the road. And we got on the outskirts of Benghazi. And we passed this... the most fantastic bar I think I've ever seen in my life. And we stopped. I said, we'll go in here. Now, we'd sent these civilians back, and they had, of course, got back into their homes. It was about a month or so, 6 weeks after the action. And they had, of course, then picked up their lives. And there were a lot of Italians in this bar. We went in. Now, we were full of desert sores. I was oil-stained, a red beard with a berry, oil-stained berry, with two pistols on the side, and that was it. That was the thing that they saw, and they were, couldn't believe it. We made all these people stay in this bar, and this bar particularly, it was all crystal glass. I've never seen anything, the ceiling, the sides, and it was so opulent. You never saw anything like it in your life. We made these people stay there, and we wanted drinks all around. We made them serve drinks all around. Nobody dared come out. And then we suddenly decided this is... I mean, the situation was such, it was a ridiculous situation where I got in. I shouldn't have been there, because there were snipers about. We were shot at quite a few times. However, and then I said to the chap, go and get one of these crates, you know, and get it open. And he brought it in, we put on this bar, and I got the owner. And I said, we'll buy this bar. And he saw this lira. There must have been thousands in there. And he couldn't believe it. So within half an hour, all his family on a vehicle straight out. And we own, that's why I say, I own property in Libya. Anyway, suffice to say, we got back, and the armored div workshops couldn't support us anymore. In other words, couldn't give us the maintenance. We were clapped out. All our machinery, all our carriers, all our vehicles, all our PUs were shot, absolutely shot. And we went back. And I took a column back by the road route through, and I got back to Tobruk and reported there. By then the red caps were there, immaculate as they were, and us absolutely looking like, and they remonstrated with us. Absolutely, I couldn't get over it. And of course there were a lot of dialogue that I won't go into at that time. Anyway, suffice to say, we finally got back, and that was it. Well, we got back to Tobruk, and the regiment went back for a refit back to Cairo, and we were doing a holdout. I forget where it was, but it was right on the coast. And, I mean, it was amazing that the water was the problem. I mean, with all those millions of liras, for argument's sake, if you'd have come across with a can of water, I'd have given you all of Italian pay corps, never mind about anything else. Because water was such, those days, if you had... You had to do shaving brush baths, if you like. One little tin of water with a shaving brush on it did everything. That's all the washing you did. And water was a very precious thing. And it used to come up in 2 gallon tins. And they were all wax lined, apparently. Well, not apparently, they were. And they used to come up through echelon to echelon, until finally we used to get them. Invariably there were leakers amongst them, so it leaked half of it. They were thrown onto vehicles, which knocked the wax off, and that's what we had, warm wax water. That's all we ever had. And I always remember Danny Plummer. He was as mad as a march hare. We had a 500 gallon bowser we'd captured from we'd taken from the Italians, and he used to go out with this bowser. He'd be away 3 and 4 days at a time, and he used to find these old beers, these wells, these old desert wells, And for some unknown reason, he managed to get water. Not 500 gallons, but enough water to help us anyway. And he used to come back, and invariably, if we were hauled down at all in a lager, invariably there was a hole dug for the lavatories and just a wooden case over the hole. And he used to come in, man's a march here, and he used to go round and round and round this lager firing at this lavatory, you know, or anyone that was on it. That was as mad he was. He was a remarkable man for Arabic. He could speak Arabic, and everything he did, he said in Arabic. Everything he did, I'm doing this or I'm doing that. And as a result, he became very, 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 very excellent.